Hello and welcome to High and Low, a Kersaw podcast. I'm your host, Gutter Cover, and with me is the Mummy.
The Mummy Returns again.
Yeah.
I mean, she didn't really say why he was the mummy. I guess because he moves slow.
Don't know, 'cause like I believe the mummy mythos is like it serves out a purpose and has a complete mission. Or something because of a curse.
Oh, so it's like the original concept of like a zombie, like
Yeah.
brought back just to fulfill something, and then they have to go back to the grave.
Kind of like, is it a golem, the Jewish thing?
Yeah, you put that note in their mouth, and then they give you money.
Yeah, like the X-Files episode where Mulder has to investigate a golem
I
murder.
haven't got to that one yet.
It's a pretty good one.
Nah, cool.
It's before season six, so it's season six. The second half of season six starts to get bad, and then after that, I think it's unforgivably bad.
I see.
But other people disagree with me, so who cares? Anyways, this is the final episode of the show.
The regular episode final show, right?
Yeah.
Are you releasing this special before this one?
I might do same day.
Oh.
Give people a double dose.
Yep. It's been a long
But
road.
it has been two years and 2 months. Yeah, because this comes out in just January 2019.
Yep, one day for every Kurosawa movie.
Yep. And having this be the end was kind of an accident, because I just was planning, like, oh, this might be the 1 year anniversary episode or whatever. Because I want to get to High and Low, because Knock and I was in it. So I was like, oh, that has high priority. I just kind of pushed this back to last, like, oh, this is a fitting way to end, us going through his stuff.
Yeah, I'd say it's an appropriate episode to end on, knowing that our impending doom was coming. We just had a lot of stuff we had to figure out, you know?
Yeah. So this is, I'm not sure if I said already, but Ikaru from 1952. And this was Follow the Idiot, which was a giant disaster for Kurosawa. He really bounced back with this one. This was paired with Gate of Hell, which I guess we should get that out of the way. Like, there's not much to compare this to with Gate of Hell.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of what I could even put near each other. I mean, do they even have actors in common? I don't.
I don't think so.
They're
But I would.
very different, very different tones, different like Gate of Hell just feels so much flashier than Ikiru. Cool.
Yeah, this has. Ikira has moments of flashiness, but Gate of Hell is just a. This is like a bombastic, melodrama of like color and costumes.
Yeah, it's a colorful, like Hollywood equivalent movie coming out of
Yeah.
Japan.
And this is more, it felt like more aimed toward a Japanese audience. At least, like, I can see the studio being like, let's not release this. This is back at Toho, because Kurosawa did The Idiot with Shochiku, the studio Ozu and Mizoguchi and Kiyoshida worked for, and Idiot was such a failure that Kurosawa said he never tried going back to Shochiku because of how much it didn't work.
That's too bad. I mean, the idiot's great. This one
Yeah. Oh.
is amazing. Like Gate of Hell just feels so vapid compared to this. Like this is a message movie. This one has amazing performances. Like I mean, Gate of Hell still has some good performances in it, but
Yeah.
it feels like filler, like popcorn. And this feels like there's a reason why it's so famous. I mean, it feels like you could study, you could tear it apart. There's all, things that they do with the camera, things that they do with the music, you know, performances, choosing to do flashbacks and narration instead of just having like a straight narrative going on.
Yeah, it's very Citizen Kane-esque.
Yeah, that's true.
And I just saw Citizen Kane for the first time, I think in this, in this late summer, or even early fall, when I saw it. But yeah, like, seeing that earlier this year, and then for the first, so I have seen an Orson Welles movie, finally. Mm-hmm. And yeah, Citizen Kane is a masterpiece. It's entertaining and really good too. So you are right.
That's all I wanted to hear this entire podcast, so I'm glad that we can finally end on a high note.
Yeah, but yeah, the Citizen Kane aspects of this really are apparent, which is strange because according to Richie and in the book, Kurosawa had not seen that movie by this point.
I believe it. When did Citizen Kane even come out?
41?
No.
1940 or 41. So I feel like it probably would have been shipped around the world by this point, but...
Yeah. Oh, no. I mean, he was a avid movie watcher. I guarantee he did watch it, but that doesn't mean it necessarily was a direct influence on what he did here. It does feel very similar, but like the characters couldn't be any more different.
Yeah, and the Richie entry for this one is really fascinating. It helped. This movie is very one of the things that makes this movie work is that it's very clear and easy to follow. Like it's done in an unconventional way, but it still is very, like, anyone, I feel like anyone could watch this and understand what's happening. And, part of the structure for this came from, Hideo Ogumi, who was one of Kurosawa's writers, because up until his last three films, he would co-write everything with at least one other writer, because in his mind, it'd be easy, it'd be a more even movie with more of one voice.
Sure.
And Ogumi apparently did not write anything in a script, like he was just kind of hanging out. And letting Hashimoto, who recently died at the age of 100 this year, and Kurosawa kind of flesh everything out, and Ogumi was hanging out and be like, "Hey, what if the last 45 minutes is just his funeral?" And like he just kind of
just throw it in.
Yeah, just throw it in, and like he kind of helped make this movie what it is. Without, you know, really contributing much as content.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like the fake Ben Affleck, Matt Damon story when they were writing Good Will Hunting. Like, yeah, Ben Affleck was just sitting around like, I don't know. I don't know. I can't remember. It's funny, though. Like, yeah, he gets a hat.
Yeah, but let's see. So Kurosawa, just like with Stray Dog and some of his other bigger movies, yeah, we've covered, he didn't like how it turned out. He felt he could have done a better job. He didn't like, he liked Shimura's performance, but he felt it was a little too rigid. Which I don't know what to think of that. I disagree with him, but he's one who made it, so who knows. He felt he could have done a better job making this movie. He felt a little too flat for him.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt that Shimura's performance was a little too rigid. And the passage. Here is, naturally, it was in this way that the character of Watanabe was created. Actually, I can't say I was completely satisfied with Shimura's interpretation. From his point of view, he gave it all he could. But if you ask me, his image of Watanabe was not the same as mine. He played the part with all stops out, and I would have preferred something a bit more relaxed. Of course, here, both the scenario and myself were also at fault. So,
well, you know, it's his movie. I guess he knows exactly what he wanted. I think that it's amazingly well done. I don't think it's perfect, but it's not for lack of anything. If anything, it has a little bit too much of him kind of navel-gazing while he's living, like, with the fact that he's going to die and he hasn't really lived, you know. I don't think... I mean, Shimura's amazing in it, so... I don't know what else he needed from him.
Yeah.
It's so hard to say.
Yeah, like some of his performance is a little too much at times, but it never... But it, those moments are kind of few and far between, and ultimately I don't think matters. Because, like, everything else just completely works. Like, it, like the moments of him being a little too mopey. Well, I mean, I understand why the character is like the way he is, but sometimes it's a little too much. But that little minor thing ultimately doesn't harm the movie at all.
Sure.
And where is it?
I mean, I feel like that plays into how the audience would react to seeing his characters, because there were so many times when I was watching it where he wasn't saying what he wanted to say or what he was thinking, and you want to reach in the screen and be like, just say it. Just, you're going to die anyways. Just say it. You know?
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Yeah, and there's some more gold from the entry in Richie's book. Here's another one. Shimura always says that he is no good. That's certainly not the truth. He grows with every film. If he did Drunken Angel with the power he has now, nothing. He has now something very different would have happened. Shimura is the kind of man who is always making things difficult for himself, and so he strains. So he strains too much.
Hmm.
Yeah. So it seems like your father was a very dedicated actor,
and that he was constantly criticizing his own craft. I can understand that. I mean, if we see one actor that, like in this entire series, that I feel like can do anything, it was probably Takashi Shimura. Like, even more so than Mifune, who is obviously the godsend of Japanese cinema, like this amazing bright star that burned out too quickly. Like, he should still been alive and, you know, making movies, but the world had to take him. Shimura, like, if you look at his library of all the different things he's done everything, and he's been everything, and, like, he's been great in everything we've seen, even something as
a quiet duel,
as my cat's fighting, as little as, like, his role in Godzilla, where he's, you know, kind of just a stiff scientist guy. It's like, that's totally different than what he was playing in here, and in Seven Samurai, and all the other things we've seen him.
Like the MVP of the series, pretty much. Like, he just is, you know, he... I think of all the actors that we have seen multiple times, he's the best. Like, Shimura, the Mifune, he, you know, he's a movie star. He had a certain persona, which is, you know, which made him a movie star. So he kind of would always play up that persona. But I don't think he was a good actor.
Yeah.
You know, depending on, you know, what was asked of him, and, you know, what the movie was. But Shimura was just, I guess he was a character actor. I don't know what the definition of a character actor would be, but he wasn't like a leading man.
I mean, he didn't. I think the definition of a character actor is somebody who you can count. Yeah, like I said, you can count on to play almost any role, and then but you don't really know what he is based on all the roles he is. You know, you wouldn't know what his personality was. Like, I think there are some times where you think that Mifune. Like, I think Mifune is also a character actor in that sense, but he's more of a movie star because I feel like there were some times where it's like, well, we're casting Mifune to be Mifune in this movie, so we're just going to let him do his thing. But that didn't happen, as far as I know, with Shimura. I think the disadvantage that Mifune has on Shimura or over Shimura is that we saw Mifune in the very beginning, like literally we saw his first role and we watched his acting evolve until he was like the star amazing actor that he became. But we saw like his low points and parts where we're like, well, his acting's not top notch right here. You know, I don't know if he really felt what he was going for. With Shimura, I think he's just been acting for so long, we haven't seen the beginning. I'm trying to think of like a time where I didn't see him at the top of his game because it feels like natural, you know. Every time he was on
Yeah.
screen, I was like, this is a natural actor we're watching right here.
Yeah, his first film, where's my film? His first film, if I remember correctly, was Osaka Elegy, Mizoguchi film, which I've seen. And his performance is pretty good, but he's barely in it.
Right.
But yeah, we didn't cover that, which would have been interesting for like early Mizoguchi stuff. Were you surprised that Mifune was not in this? Like, were you expecting him to show up?
No, I wasn't, because if Mifune's in a movie, he becomes the star based on posters and all this other stuff, and there was no sign of him anywhere. It was
Oh,
all
okay.
just Shimura front and center. Like, you know, in Drunken Angel, it's like Shimura's the, like we were talking about, Shimura's the star of that movie, but you wouldn't be able to tell based on the material that was released for it. It's like, ooh, Mifune is the star of Drunken. He is the Drunken Angel. Well, no, actually, okay, fine.
Okay, so Toho did not release Ikaru, which translates to not to say they live, to it's the verb for to
Yeah, I
live.
thought it was to live. Yeah.
And where is it? So this didn't come out in America until 1960. So you know who reviewed it?
That guy who hates Kurosawa movies?
Yeah.
Oh, what'd he say?
I'm looking for that he starts it with for a varied and detailed illustration of middle class life in modern Japan, with a good deal of caustic social comment and extra thick sentiment thrown in. Kurosawa's Ikaru, let's skip that part. It opened at Little Carnegie yesterday, which I guess Little Carnegie, which I guess was a theater in the 60s. It's the most expressive. It does hold the most expressive and cinematic style, and if it weren't so confused in its storytelling, it would be one of the major post-war films from Japan.
I can't follow the story. I'm a bad self-critic.
Yeah, and then he says, then the last 3rd or 45 minutes of it is an odd sort of jumbled epilogue, in which the last charitable act of the deceased man is crudely reconstructed. Yeah, it just kind of goes on. It's like it could have been a great movie, but it's not.
I so dig that last scene because yes, we could have seen him rushing back and forth and you know, trying to get his papers stamped so that they can have movements on the project and all this stuff like that. And they could have made it interesting. Like he's made interesting things like that, you know, what's it called with when the Mifune movie where he loses his gun.
Oh, Stray Dog? Stray
Dog. So in Stray Dog, we've got that whole long scene where he's trying to get in so that he can meet somebody who sells guns. And it's, you know, that's like a 8-minute long montage of him just walking around the street with almost no dialogue the whole time. And, you know, he's... Kurosawa was perfectly capable of doing that. But the way they lay this out, it reminded me of what he did in his final movie, Amada Daio, where, you know, people are just relaying these stories, but inserting, mm-hmm. you know, the few times where we get to see Shimura go and do the marching around that the women in the beginning of this movie had to do. Like, you got to see that he knows the hoops, and he's always known these hoops that he had to jump through. And I think it's better that we're watching all of his, you know, quote-unquote colleagues have to figure out why this guy decided to give a shit at this point in his life.
Yeah.
And, like, the narrator lays it out. Well, our protagonist is dead, but let's hear what everybody else has to say about it. And I think it's such an interesting way to do it rather than just showing us, you know.
Yeah. Were you surprised by that reveal? Because I kept that secret from you.
Oh.
Because I always said it takes a interesting turn.
That he was just suddenly dead at 50 minutes still, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I was surprised because I thought maybe what they would do would be like, well, here's our dead protagonist. And then, like, maybe flashback into him doing what I was just talking about instead of just the whole funeral for the rest of the time. But I liked it. I liked the turn.
Okay. Yeah, when I first saw this, it was just, I found it really jarring, and I was like, is the movie over?
You're like, wait a minute. I forgot the rest of the movie. I gotta go back to the video store.
Yeah, I love that turn at the end, because it's like, you mentioned Amada Daio, where, like, there's the whole, the festival scenes that, like, go on, like, for a long time in those movies, where it's like, how long are they going to do this? But, like, but it's also was very, very, very entertaining, too. And it's like the shift of, like, Kurosawa stuff. No one's home. I think, like, one of the local cats is out and about, or, like, a squirrel is nearby.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's some cats that hang out around this part of the neighborhood, so I feel like she's going crazy because of the cats.
And it just means there's trouble. There's trouble around.
Yeah.
She's watching out for you.
It's wonderful when you're laying down and she's right next to you and starts barking in your ear. It's the best feeling in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're lucky owning cats who don't bark.
No, I have cats that do other things. It's
okay. I was going. Oh yeah, Amada Daio. How, like, they're just these long extended sections, and the whole funeral thing feels like a precursor to him doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this feels like the a predecessor to Amada Daio.
Yeah, but, well, it also feels like an extension of the Bad Sleep Well.
Explain.
Well, like, I feel like that had a whole bunch of businessman bureaucracy things going on that, you know, they had more sinister things, but, you know, people working for other people that had to follow people's orders and all that stuff like that, and there happened to be this, like, revenge story going on in there, but I felt a little brushes of that with the whole commentary on bureaucracy thing here.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. I'm not sure if you knew it, this. Where was it? This was a inspired. It's a kind of a loose adaptation of a Tolstoy story. Where is it?
The Death of Ivan Illich.
Ivan
Ivan Illich.
Yeah. So that means Alistair will have four Kurosawa episodes at some point.
I mean, that's only if he's covered the entirety of Russian cinema.
Yeah.
When's he going to do...
There, Sue?
Yeah.
I don't know, because that's only, like, only truly Russian thing. But he did do Lady Macbeth, which is based off of a Russian novel.
Right. Nadersu's and like a Russian co-production at the very least.
Yeah. So, I mean, and The Idiot is a... I always say his... I feel like I say his name wrong every time.
Dostoevsky?
Yes, whatever you said is a little literal adaptation of that, so...
Right.
But,
And The Lower Depths.
Yeah. Yeah, I forgot Lower Depths, too.
I was saying that it feels like... to me, it felt like...
An extension of
The Bad Sleep Well, and that's right, yeah.
Yeah, and this is like the outlier of this era for filmmaking, because this is the only film between Drunken Angel and Redbeard where Toshiro does not appear.
Mm.
Which, when I first saw it, I didn't know Toshiro wasn't in it, because I was just going through on Netflix DVD all of the, all Kurosawa. I think I got through about 15 or so, and then I stopped. I didn't want to burn out too quickly.
Sure.
But this was just a real shock of, like, oh, it's the guy from Scandal.
Yeah.
The whole time, yeah. But his character in Scandal feels like a lesser version of Watanabe.
Mm-hmm.
Where, like, it's like the same, like similar setup, you know, just kind of living a sad, dull life where there's, like, nothing happening. And with Scandal, it's not done as well, because that movie was kind of first and a bit rushed and feels a bit rushed. And this was this Kurosawa, I feel like him kind of doing Scandal over again, but focusing on the lawyer character. Like the central character is similar to the lawyer in Scandal.
That guy was super shade, or that guy was like a, oh, okay, yeah, he was like a meek guy too. I understand that, but. I was looking at, Shimura's stuff, and yeah, I don't really, I mean, yeah, I can see shades of it in that character, but I'm not really feeling anything else in particular.
I mean, it feels like taking that character and extending it into, you know, into his full, into like a movie all about him.
It feels like a character dropped out of an Ozu movie, you know, somebody who's just had a very small life, didn't make any big noises, just went to work every day and like, didn't talk very much, didn't have friends, really, and like, then this thing happens, this tragedy happens, and instead of, like, focusing, like, in Ozu movies where you focus on a bunch of different people, it just focuses on this guy and what he's going on. I thought something terrible was going to happen when he went out on night on the town with whoever that guy was, that fiction writer.
Mephistocles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's, Richie brings up something interesting about that whole thing that I never even thought of. Because, like, Mephistocles is, I can't remember where it's from. I think it might be an opera, and it's, you know, the devil. And, like, he kind of shows, and he, like, shows Watanabe like all these sinful things, like they go to a strip show, you know, there's lust, and they go gambling, and they drink, and they, you know, pick up whores.
Are you just like presume you said, those ladies are prostitutes? I mean, they're just, you know, they're just nice young ladies.
Yeah, I mean, she's wearing falsies and takes them off because she's, you know, about to retire for the night.
I see.
But, yeah, I never made a connection of, like, oh, this is kind of him, like, experiencing, you know, like, not a vision of hell, necessarily, But like showing, you know, it's being like, oh, I'm gonna die, so why not experience all these things that I never did in my life?
Yeah.
Just kind of crammed into one night.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I do feel bad that he got his hat stolen and it's just like, nope, you're never gonna get it back. Like, that's lame. Don't steal a person's hat.
Yeah, and I love that the hat is hugely important. Not hugely important, but like it, you know, it's symbolic of him. And it's like you get the feeling like the hat he wears. Not again.
Don't worry about
In
it.
the beginning, is the same hat he's had for years, and when he gets a new, like, you know, white fancy hat, all the coworkers are like, "See, you had like, oh my God, he's wearing a different hat. What's happening?"
Flashy, showy hat. Who's he showing off for?
Yeah,
Nobody. He just got that. He doesn't even seem. I mean, he seems attached to the hat in the sense that he wears it all the time, but it's not like this is my special hat.
but I mean, like it, you know, it's symbolic of this. It's basic, it's normal, it's standard, and it's only he has this fancy hat that's different, and
Right, it's the
it's a sign.
only like outwardly physical change of his character because people have just been ignoring the fact that he looks sickly and he like thinner. You know, they'll do a little side comment, but not really. It's not really discussion worthy. But as soon as he gets that hat, it's like, oh my God, is he having an affair with a younger woman or something like that? What's going on? This is crazy.
I'm not sure if you noticed, but two of his co-workers that work under him, whatever, I wasn't clear on like the bureaucracy stuff on like
Well, I think that was the
who.
purpose, yeah.
So like two of the people, oh yeah, that does make sense. And two of the people that he works with or is a boss of or whatever are the two peasants from Penn Fortress. I don't think they are in a scene together at any point, but it is no it is very notable to be like, oh, it's it, it oh they're together, but
I recognized so many faces in this. It was kind of perfect that way for like an ending that all these players came back to like take a bow, except for Mifune, which I think that's symbolic of like the fact that we're not dropping Mifune. I mean, he's going to be back, you know, going through our lives the whole time. Some of these people, unless we're actively seeking out Japanese movies from this era, we might not see them again.
Oh yeah, I think Noriko Sengoku was like a bartender in a very brief moment. She's the girl from she's the nurse in Quiet Duel who has the baby, and she might be in Rashomon in a small role. She's in Stray Dog. She's in I Live in Fear. She does get like these kind of small minor roles with Kurosawa.
Sure.
I think she might have been a bartender, but she's not. It's not listed on like IMDb or anything.
Yeah.
But you know, it's that's not always accurate.
Yeah.
So it. What did you think of like the overall style of like the first half versus the second half?
I mean, I like it like touches on so many different ways of going about like him just sitting in that office working in his home life and then like him actually traveling the streets. We're seeing all these different opportunities to do awesome, you know, cool things with the camera and there's that one shot where there, I can't remember what's going on. I think it's on his night out in the town. The camera's like kind of pulling back, watching as they walk towards where the camera is on a, like a, at the end of a street or something like that. And then they like start going upstairs, but the camera doesn't change. It like lifts up with them. So it must have been on a crane or something like that as it was going along. And it's
Oh,
like this is
yeah.
an interesting shot to just stick in there, and I love it.
Yeah, and I like a lot of the like extreme close-ups, not extreme close-ups, but like it would just be a shot in the whole shot would be someone's face.
Yeah.
And that just would make everything that much more, like, intimate and emotional. And it's, you know, it's easier to connect with the drama, with these close-ups of people's face with, you know, and they just make an expression, not necessarily talk.
Yeah.
Like, it felt kind of like a silent movie-ish.
Expressionism, for sure.
The expression, yeah.
It reminded me of The Idiot, because the quote-unquote idiot of that movie always had this expression that people couldn't, like, look away from, this look of pure innocence type of thing. And, like, everyone looking in Shimura's face in this movie could see the depths of pain and sadness inside him. And you know, there's that part where the Yakuza are basically show up to, like, try to intimidate him. They take one look at his face and they're like, oh, this guy's long gone. Let's just walk away.
Yeah, it was Kato from Seven Samurai.
Mm-hmm.
And Yojimbo. I recognize his weird looking face immediately.
Yeah,
he had a big like fake scar that looked pretty good. It didn't look too silly.
Yeah, I didn't think it was fake. Thought he got a scar in between movies.
Yeah, you know he has a chubby cheeks. You know, maybe got a fight over.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. And maybe Joe Shishido saw him and was like, oh, why don't I look like him?
Give me that injection immediately.
Yeah, except, you know, Joe didn't have the other chubbiness. He's had chubby cheeks.
Yeah.
But, let's see. Do you want to kind of skim through the plot? What little... I mean, like, not... It's not very plot-heavy, necessarily. It's kind of more of a character piece.
Yeah.
Where stuff happens, kind of like Ozu, like you mentioned.
Yeah, there's only a couple of like really, really good points to talk about. So, our main character, played by Takashi Shimura, is a man named Watanabe. He is the head of his department, which is a public works department. And he's, you know, the narrator who comes in out is during the movie is just says, this guy's got a super boring life and it totally sucks. And you know what? He's about to find out he's going to die. So what do you think of that, dude?
And the first thing we see is a picture of his x-ray.
Yep.
Of his, you know, of his stomach that has a tumor on it. And says, this is the stomach of our protagonist. He's going to die.
He doesn't even know it yet. We know it before him. And he just, you know, we see him taking stomach medication and stuff like that, but that's it. You know, he moves very slow. And the next time we see him out of the office is he's at the doctor's office. He's got some scans, and of course there's some for some reason in Japanese movies when you're at the hospital, some guy's about to tell you how bad it could be.
Just like in The Last Dance.
Yeah. Was there another there? Yeah, there was a scene where they're like, "Oh, don't worry, you know." Like if he tells you this, it's really bad, and that's exactly what happens. So was that a throwback to this movie?
Given that it's Juzo Itami, it probably is a direct reference.
That's
he likes a reference, like stuff he likes.
Oh, yep. I hope that's not actually the standard.
Like Tampopo is full of little things of like, as I watch like more Boonwell stuff, like, oh, this is like Boonwell. I just didn't pick up on it before.
And westerns, right? It's like a bunch of different westerns.
Yeah, and some Roman porno, 70s like Japanese softcore references to with the oyster kiss thing.
Gross.
Yeah, but the series called me and Martin brought it up. It's called like G-string. Deep Sea Diver or something.
Oh yeah, I've got all those.
And it's like this soft, these comedy, softcore comedies about a deep sea diver and her like erotic adventures.
Yep, sounds like a hoot.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, Juzo Itami, watch his movies; they're totally worth watching.
So yeah, he finds out I mean, the doctors try to play it off that he has an ulcer, but he knows that that means he's got cancer, because... The funny thing is, when the guy was explaining, like, you know, he said, like, oh, if they tell you you have a little ulcer, you know, that means that you actually have cancer and you're going to die. And then he goes through all the things to indicate how you actually know if you have cancer. And, you know, Shimura doesn't say a word, but you can tell by his face, he's like, all those things are happening to me.
Yeah, and trying to way that we see his face as he's being told all this. And then the guy realizes, oh, I shouldn't have done this.
Yeah. Like, oh man, now he's going to be sad. So he proceeds to disappear from work for several days, which is unusual. Like, they even comment that, like, oh, like a couple more weeks and he would have had the record for never taking a sick day, you know, in 30 years.
Yeah.
And there's one character that works in the office that's like, I'm going to quit. This job is just too boring. I need the boss to sign off on it, though. It's like, okay, well, make note of that for later.
Yeah.
After he got the diagnosis, he goes home.
Yeah, I'm here. His son is played by Nobu Kaneko, who was in the Joshishido movie we did.
Detective Bureau 2 through plus 3, Go to Hell Bastards.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's in the Battles Without Honor Anti-Humanity series. I think he's in all of them, including the three kind of sequels to the original five.
Cool.
Yeah, he's had an interesting career. It's weird seeing him in something like this. I'm used to seeing him stuff that's silly, but, like, you know, seeing him in the Joe movie and then seeing him in this a decade younger, it's like, oh, wow, this is he aged a lot in 10 years.
Yeah, the picture that they have on Letterboxd, I don't recognize him. I was like, that can't be the right actor, but I guess he's just an older man. He's young and Akiru. He hadn't quite grown into his face yet.
No.
But I really like this scene where he goes home and, you know, his children, or his son and his son's wife go through the house and they're complaining, they're kvetching the whole time. Like, oh, it's so cold, nobody locked the door, all the lights are out, what the hell's going on? Like, oh, maybe when your father retires, we can ask him for the money, or like, he'll just give us the money, we can buy a new house. Ha ha, if he ever does, he's not going to take all that money with him when he dies. Ha 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 ha. And then they turn on the light in their bedroom, and hey, dad's in there. What's he doing? He's just crouched down. And, like, they are upset by this, because he's in their bedroom with all the lights off. It's weird. I understand. He goes downstairs and he starts having these really powerful memories about his son and how important his son, Mitsuo, is to him. You know, he flashes back to when his wife, Mitsuo's mother, died, and them, you know, going to bury her or put her to rest wherever that is. And then there's a scene where he's, you know, very excited, happy, watching his son play baseball, and he's proud of his son, and like, he kind of, it's that's a little strange, because, you know, his son tries to steal a base and he gets caught, and the guy next to him is like, ah, that idiot, and he's like, huh, okay, well, I guess I won't brag about my son right now.
Yeah.
And then the scene on the train where he's going to war, where his son is going off to fight. And, mm-hmm. you know, like, he's just got we don't see Shimura, but there's a man looking up at his son, and his son finally looks down at him. He says, "Father," and the train starts to go off. And it's like, my God, like, they pack so much history in just these three little flashback scenes. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's like maybe 2 minutes at the most, 2-3 minutes.
Yeah.
It's not much, and it's this, like, for a 2.5 hour long movie, it really did a great job of condensing, you know, so much personal history into, you know, this, into minutes of, like, okay, there will be no exposition. It's just, you get these three scenes, and it's clearly understood how he feels about his son and how his son feels about him. That's with these two scenes.
And it's, you know, throughout the movie, Shimura is saying that, like, I did this all for my son, all this stuff like that. And the one thing I think is missing is that we don't really get an explanation as to why their relationship fell apart, because they don't really seem to communicate, you know? They're just, like, occupy the same space on occasion.
I got the feeling it's because he worked all the time, and he probably wasn't there for his son because he was always working.
Yeah, yeah. But you don't really see it break down or anything like that. I mean, I can presume that he was working when he was watching his kid play baseball. But I mean, he still had the job or something. He'd been working there for 30 years, for God's sake.
Yeah, but I mean, like, because they're rich enough to have a maid who lives there. So, and given that, you know, this is work ethic and, you know, it just seems like he just wasn't always there for his son, even though he tried to be. But I also don't think it's necessary to explain all that, because you can interpret their relationship, you know, in a couple different ways.
All right, you can extrapolate upon what we're seeing just based on where everybody is at. And, like, his son doesn't... It feels like he doesn't respect his father because he feels like his father's always withheld money or something like that. That seems to be the hot button issue with his family. Because when he goes and talks to his uncle, Matsuo goes and talks to his uncle, it's like, oh, your dad's always been a miser, you know, and he came over here the other day and I was like, if this is about a loan, you just get out of here. And he didn't say a damn thing. It's like, seriously, guys.
Like, can't you tell us by looking at him something's wrong?
Yeah. But no, they have to come up with another explanation. Because the logical thing is you would think that if somebody was dying, they would tell you. So I understand that. Especially, you know, family members and stuff like that.
Yeah, but he's just been so just beaten down with a, you know, boredom of, you know, of life that, I don't know where I'm going with this.
No, I mean, I know why he doesn't do it either. I mean, you don't want to burden your family with that particular information. Like, he's so much in shock that he doesn't know what to do. And, I mean, he definitely tries to tell his son at one point, and once again, his son is like, hey, don't be bringing a young woman around. It's disgraceful. You make me sick, old man. I'm like, holy shit. I guess I'm not supposed to like his son because fuck him.
Yeah, it like, that scene goes into, like, Mizoguchi territory of, like, oh, life sucks and there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah. Yeah, not, it's not nice. But so Shimura, after he figures that out, he basically disappears for a while from most people's view, and we pick up, he's at just some random bar where he's drinking, and he says, you know, I've never drank him before, the guy he's talking to, he says this to him, but he also tells this guy, I've got stomach cancer. He's like, well, you're basically committing suicide by doing this. He's like, doesn't say a thing. Oh, well, he says, like, you know, I keep thinking, yeah, you should just kill yourself, but I don't have the strength to do it because, I mean, how can I kill myself if I haven't actually lived yet?
Yeah, like, I don't know if they say that, but yeah, this is when he meets the novelist.
Yeah.
Who calls himself Mephistocles, and there's a black, small dog in the area. And he's like, oh, appropriate, which is a nice little literary reference of, like, to Mephistocles, and I believe it was an opera. I've read it in literature class in college, but it's been a few years. Oh, yeah, the literary stuff in this Kurosawa was not happy with. In the end, he felt it it bogged it down too much, and didn't well, it wasn't as interesting as his other movies. Like, he threw in some literary references, and like he felt it like with the Mephistocles guy, like that, and he felt it was too stagey.
Well, I don't think it's too stagey, but I'm not the director, so.
Yeah, but it's just weird. Like, why would you, if you're, I don't know. He never seemed to like his own movies that much to begin with,
Yeah.
either.
You seem kind of a grumpy gus about it.
Yeah.
I mean, this part is like from a play, though, because, like, yeah, he meets the devil and the devil takes him around and shows him all the sights. That's the whole scene, And there's this beautiful part where they're in a piano bar, and I don't know if the scene is racist, but I felt a little racist watching this guy playing the piano. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No.
Okay. I just felt like he was imitating like a black actor from back then doing jazzy piano with his hair, even with the way his hair was styled and stuff like that.
Yeah, I guess, but this was 1952, so American culture was, already firmly in place.
No, I understand. He was doing it because it was something that he liked and had seen and probably had been working on. It just was very, very. I felt like it was in other Hollywood movies that are showing piano bars. There's characters like this, and they're always African American. And so
Huh.
he's got, he's even doing the whoa, kind of thing.
I never made that connection that like they're usually African American.
That's, you know what? It's just me being racist.
No, it makes sense. My great grandfather, he did I think kind of like that too. So yeah, I've never made that connection before.
Yeah, and like you said, they're just adapting American culture and something they're seeing, and people like to dance to it and stuff like that.
Yeah,
And he.
so this is the second like Kurosawa movie I can think of that has like a Hollywood kind of dance number.
Yeah.
It's not like Toshiro, like shaking his butt and doing like the swing dancing. It's not that level, but it's still very like still orchestrated, and like it's this part of this like a Western style show at this piano bar.
Right. And Stray Dog has that whole like scene with the dancers right on stage.
Oh yeah, Stray Dog too. I forgot that.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's around this era, around this time period when he's making contemporary movies. I have to reference the clubs. So he gets the piano player to play an old Japanese song that becomes the theme, where it's about, like, live your life. Life is short, young maiden. Go out there and love and stuff like that. And he's, I don't know if it's actually Shimura singing it, but they do a low voiced sing along with that. Like, it stuns the people in the bar to the point where they all stop dancing and they just watch this old man sing. And
Yeah, it's
it's
really
beautiful.
proof. Yeah, it's really interesting because like he doesn't like this. There's a it, you can either see it as he just bumps everyone out, but at the same time, it's also like it's just such a wonderful moment of people reflecting on, life because the song he picks.
Yeah. I think if it was something that they didn't like, they would have stopped playing, that guy could have stopped playing the piano altogether. But I think it was, yeah, everybody just taking a moment to reflect.
Yeah, and this comes back in the end in a really big way.
Yeah.
And what is the iconic scene? If you see a poster of this, it's like what I was referencing. I mean, I've seen what I'm talking about with like this coming back.
Have you seen the poster on Wikipedia?
Wikipedia? No.
It's him on the swing, but next to him is the girl that starts hanging around with him, and she's like standing on the swing. It makes it look like it's like a Charlie Chaplin-esque, I don't know, comedy, I guess. Like, no, that didn't happen.
That's a weird poster.
Yeah. Used to the Criterion image. So, I mean, the end, his night of debauchery ends after, yeah, they pick up a couple of prostitutes and he gets out of the car and throws up. And the guy who's been rushing him around, like, gets out and he just makes this face where it's like, I am dying. And the guy's like, oh, man, we need to stop. Like, this isn't helping you. You're not feeling any better. And so he does stop and he ends up going home. And that's... the next time we see him, he's just walking down the street and that young lady from his office finally catches up to him and she's cheerful and happy. She's kind of like the, schoolgirl in Drunken Angel, you know, it's like, hey, the world hasn't gotten me down yet.
Yeah.
And yeah, he attaches onto that vigor, you know, and decides after he takes her back to the house, which, whoo, scandal. The maid sees it, starts talking to his son about it, and starts talking to everybody about it. Can't trust the maid. And he stamps her papers, and then he notices she has a hole in her stocking. And so they decide to go back, you know, to the office, is what he says. But on the way, they stop, and he buys her new stockings. And she's overjoyed about it, and then they go... They basically just have, like, a whole day out doing things, you know, like he's constantly feeding her, you know, sweets or just expensive looking food. They have
it's not like he's trying to seduce her or anything. It's just him trying to, you know, spend time with someone because no one wants to spend time with him.
Right, he's spending time observing someone who still has life in her body, and he, you know, a lot of the times he's just kind of staring at her while it's going on. And, like, he's feeling joy seeing her feeling joyful. And so he kind of gets a spark of, like, what he's been missing. You know, just going through the motions of life. He hasn't been seeing, feeling joy or bringing joy to other people in quite some time. But after this first night, apparently he keeps on, you know, trying to take her out and stuff like that, to the point where she is like, I don't want to do this anymore. You're creeping me out, old man. Yeah. You know, like, I don't want this March, December romance that you're trying to pull. And he's like, oh, no, it's not, you know, he doesn't really talk in the movie. He's like, kind of like, no, it's not that. It's,
yeah, he barely speaks in like the 2.5 hours.
Yeah. And during this conversation, when she finally is like, I'm not going to do this anymore. I don't want to. He's like, I'm just around you all the time because I want to see why you're so happy and what makes you alive and how I can possibly ever feel that way. You know, I'm dying of cancer and I want to know what I can do. And she takes out this mechanical bunny. And it's like, well, at my new job, I focus on my work and this makes me happy. Like, I feel like by making these children's toys, I'm saying hello to every child born in Japan. And that, like, sparks something in him right after that moment.
And that's, and then the narrator says, 5 months later, our hero dies.
Well, right before that happens, we do actually see him back at the office, and everyone's like, whose new hat is this? What the hell? Oh, and there he is at his desk, and he's, like, bringing paper, like, we were already talking about replacing you, and everyone's like, what's going on? He stands up, and he's like, I need to get this form filled out right away. There was a beginning part of the movie. I forgot where these ladies are going from.
Yeah, these housewives with children want this area cleaned up because it's all dirty, which that goes back to a
Drunken Angel. Yeah.
A Stray Dog of, like, you know, it's the after effects of the war. Like, you know, not everything is cleaned up or, like, fixed up. Some places are still... Damn, I feel like that was a comment on the post-war society.
Right, yeah, and not listening to the people that aren't rich and aren't expecting things to be done and can't get you in trouble, you know, not actually listening to your constituency.
Yeah.
And
they are public servants. It is their job, yeah, to.
I like that scene. You know, every desk they go to, some people are nice, some people are just a blunt. When they finally get to the deputy mayor, he's like, "I'm so glad you came to me with this problem. You know, these are the kind of problems we have designed our public works specifically for. So I need you to go back to them." So back to the beginning. But this is the paper, yeah, that Shimura lifts up and says, "I need to take care of this. We need to take care of it right now. Let's get a car together and go to the site." And then we flash to the funeral.
Yeah. And then he got about 45 minutes. Yeah.
He went outside and got hit by a truck. That was the twist.
Yeah, I don't like those type of jokes. Have you ever witnessed a hit and run?
Yeah.
Oh. Okay, I have too. I was 10, and it is traumatizing.
Well, I can understand that.
I didn't mean to bring everything down, but I really just hate those type of jokes.
All right, I'll remember from now on.
Yeah, so okay, then the funeral.
He got hit by a plane. Is that better?
Sure, that's better. Then we cut to the funeral. And the funeral. This feels the most Citizen Kane. Because before this, you get some flashbacks and stuff. And, camera wise, like, I think the first half is, like, more. It's definitely like more stylish, more like specific with what it's trying to do with like and dynamic and lively. And then you get to this second half where it's just kind of like the Citizen Kane thing of like the young reporter. You know, he's talking to people and you get flashbacks of Kane's life. And then, but with this, it's these reporters, you know, are like, is it true that the guy who died in the park, it was his idea? And then, you know, they're all drunk and they kind of discuss all the steps and they realize, oh, maybe we should change.
Yeah. You get to see the top brass people be assholes. Like, no, it was everybody. Yeah. But I mean, it was mostly me, but everybody deserves credit, you know, but definitely not the guy who died because, I mean, he's just one lowly head of a department. And he's just a cog in the system. So he couldn't have done it without everybody else. And, oh, we got to go. We're very important people. And there's a part where all the moms from that neighborhood that they fixed up. Because what they ended up doing is they built a park. You know, they get rid of the cesspool by building a park over it for children.
Yeah.
And so all these mothers from the neighborhood show up while the bigwigs are still there. And they're all crying and bowing at his altar and stuff like that. And it's this moment. And, like, you can see they're incredibly uncomfortable with what's going on. Like, jeez, what's the big deal? Like, these people didn't even know him. It's like, in a way, they kind of knew him better than you did. Especially at the end.
This part, I like this series of flashbacks because you get the slow progression of the how the process went, and as he's dying of stomach cancer, he becomes a happier person because he's actually doing something and actually like finding purpose with his life.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, it's very bittersweet. It's very, you know, it's just so uplifting, but there's the sadness of well, he's dead and he can't continue to do this. But it's this scene of flashbacks of them being like, oh, he actually was a pretty good person, it turns out, you know, towards the end.
Yeah.
And
his family's there and they're talking about it like, did they one of the things they're talking about is, like, did he know he had cancer? It's like, oh, no. Thank God he never found out. And he just kind of died quietly at this park. Because it would have been terrible for him. And then as the scene goes on, all his compatriots from work are, like, talking about, like, well, it doesn't make any sense. Why would he have done this? Why? And then, like, through flashbacks, you see, like, well, I saw him, you know, kind of stumbling at this one point. And he was talking about how, like, I don't have time to do that. You know, I don't have time to watch a sunset. I don't have time to something else.
Yeah. And we never see a sky until a flashback. And he's watching a sunset and he enjoys it for a very brief moment.
Yeah.
But then he's like, no, I'm too busy. I have to make this thing.
I have to do this before it's all over. Yeah. And yeah, they
have to help, you know, the children have to help them
through, you know, through these flashbacks and deductions. They come to the conclusion that he must have known that he had cancer and was dying. And like his asshole brother is at the funeral. He's like, no, I think he got the vigor of life because he had a girlfriend. And everyone's like, oh yeah, that makes sense. And then, you know, people are like, no, that doesn't make any sense. Like, he wasn't, if she was like such a big part of his life, wasn't she there during this whole period? You know, she was like, she didn't exist. And when they come to the conclusion that he must have known he died, his son and his daughter-in-law go off to the side and they're like, before he went to the park that last night, he left all his banknotes and his personal stamp and all the prepared so that the money could go to us. And the daughter-in-law is like, why would he do that? And they're like, I don't know. He must have known. And the son is like, how dare he not tell us? And it's like, the reason he says that is because he feels fucking guilty for being an asshole. Like if he had told me he was dying, I wouldn't have been an asshole. Like, well, don't be an asshole.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, the uncle comes in. He's like, you know, now that I think about it, why isn't his girlfriend here? Or maybe she wasn't his girlfriend. Duh. Yeah.
And I forgot who, like, what exactly sparks this flashback. You get the police officer comes in.
Yeah.
And he's like, who discovered a body in his amazing scene. That's like, it feels almost like a fantasy sequence. It's so, like, lush compared to everything else in the movie. When he's at the night where he died, and, like, at the park, and it's snowing, and it's, like, you know, lit perfectly.
Yeah.
And it's just slowly going through,
Jungle Gym or whatever.
Yeah. You know, the Jungle Gym, and he just is singing, and just ends on, you know, and that's the iconic shot of the movie, and it's just so beautiful. Like, it's one of the best moments I've ever seen in a movie.
Yeah, it doesn't feel bleak. It feels kind of magical. It reminds me of One Wonderful Sunday during some of the parts where the couple were actually fantasizing of this better life that they could have. You know, specifically the part where they're like at the bombed out buildings and they're like, mm-hmm. This could be our house. You know, this our kitchen can be over here and stuff like that. It's got this magic to it that it's perfect. Like you, I don't know what else to say.
Yeah, like allegedly this is one of Spielberg's favorite movies. If not his favorite movie, I forgot which.
His favorite movie is Bikini Car Wash.
Okay. No, but watching this now and knowing Spielberg is a huge fan of it, it's like, oh yeah, that makes sense. I can understand how this would have impacted him.
Yeah.
Just like the moment alone, I don't think would necessarily work. But you need like this. The one thing it would work. I still think it would work without the rest of the movie. But when you just watch a whole movie and it just you get to that one moment, it's just so. It's so rewarding just to see, you know, him finally happy.
It's like, because of the way this movie is represented poster-wise nowadays, like, that's the famous image of him on the swing. I was anticipating that the whole time. I didn't know it was, like, literally the last shot. And it doesn't take away from the scene that I knew that that was going to happen at some point. But yeah,
like, that reminds me, it's like the inverse of the Insect Woman, the Criterion cover, that memoir movie. Because if you've seen the Insect Woman, and you know what that scene is referencing, it's like, instead of, like, with this, it's beautiful and haunting. With Insect Woman, it's like, oh no, that's really fucking disgusting when you know the context of it. But anyway, watch Insect Woman if you want to know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah, but after, you know, the funeral, you get a little epilogue where, you know, a new guy filled in is a new boss or something.
Yeah, it's Mr. Ono here, who is just one of the other people.
Yeah, Fujiwara from End Fortress, the short one. And he is just being an oblivious dick about his job and being like, I'm not going to help anyone.
Oh, he's doing exactly what Shimura was doing in the beginning. Look at the paper stamp. Look at the paper stamp.
And then, you know, one guy, like, he stands up and gives him a look like, didn't you learn anything? It's wordless, but, you know, it's just a, you know who, the look he's saying, like, didn't you learn anything from this funeral, from talking about his life? And, you know, Fujiwara, he either forgot or just flat out doesn't care. And then it ends with, you know, seeing kids playing a playground. And then, you know, a shot of this, of, it's like the shot of when you see the sunset. And it's a guy, I forgot who it was.
It's the young guy who stood up during the meeting. And the one that was at the, during the funeral, was saying, like, Watanabe, like, built this himself. Like, he should be getting all the credit. Stuff like that. And he's, I think he's a guy from Matadayo, one of the students.
It makes sense.
But, see, in that scene, what happens is those ladies come and they're complaining that there's sewage in the thing, and the guy comes over to Ono, who's now the head of the department, and he's like, send him to Public Works, Desk 6, or whatever. It's like, okay. So he goes back, and the guy tells him, oh, go to 6. Like, so those ladies start to walk off. And this guy, who was standing up for Watanabe during his funeral, stands up and throws his chair back, like, I'm going to do something about this. I'm going to be like Watanabe. And everyone looks at him like, this is just the way life is right now. This, we're not going to change anything. I know we all talked about that, but life is the way it is. We're not all going to die tomorrow. As far as we know, let's just keep the cogs going in this machine the way it always has. And he's like defeated by all these people looking at him and going like, nope, we're not doing this.
But, you know, and he gets literally swallowed up by the papers around him.
Yep.
But it ends with him looking at the sunset the same way he was looking at the same, I believe he was with Watanabe when he saw a sunset. And it's, and he looks at sunset in a similar way. And it ends on a glimmer of maybe he'll change.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, what else would that end shot be representing exactly, of him looking at the sunset in, like, the same way?
Just remembering what a man did, what a man was capable of doing. I don't know if that means that anything is going to change. I think the ending is more dour than that.
Hmm.
Like I said, that reminds me of the Bad Sleep Well, where it's, you know, basically at the end of, to spoil the end of that movie, they get away with murder and everything just goes back to normal. Like, nothing's gonna change.
Yeah. But either way, this is a phenomenal film.
Yeah, I don't.
Oh, there's one last.
Yeah, the ending doesn't bring down the movie.
There are a couple things I want to bring up. One was Richie brings up in the book that Watanabe, in the first half, he's living in the past and is obsessed with, making sure that he, can provide for his son by working all the time. And there's a flashback of his son, and he's so recently broken up over his wife, and it brings up that he's living in the past and he has no present or future. He's just, he's just like, the embodiment of like modern, of like, I forgot one of that. But then in a second, but with the last part of it, with the funeral, like they are discussing the past, but like instead of like they're living in the past, but the past they're living is was the future of the first half. Like it, I can't remember. I have to find a segment how he words it, but like he, but like the past when is like recontextualized into like we get to see, his Watanabe's future after, we leave him, after he's alive. This is a real fascinating thing. I'm explaining it poorly, but it's a real fascinating thing he brings up about how the past is used in the two halves of this movie. And there's a 52 Ozu movie called Flavor of Green Tea Over Rice, which has not been released on any disc format, at least in this part of the world. But there's it's kind of like the late spring with like the whole daughter getting married thing, but that's just kind of a cover for like, oh, it's actually about the marriage of this husband and wife that isn't going well, and like how this ties, Ikaru ties into the whole thing of like, looks like the boredom of every life, and Flavor Green Tea Over Rice does that, but focusing on a married couple, and where it really connects with Ikaru is with the scene where you learn why the movie's called Green Flavor Green Tea Over Rice, which I won't explain. Well, is it available? Not really available. But like, I won't get into it too much, but it really thematically ties into what Ikaru is doing with like the. With like the key scene at the end of Flavor Green Tea Over Rice. Like it would be an interesting companion piece, even though it's not my favorite. It's mid-tier Ozu for me, but like the scene where you learn why it's called what's called is one of my favorite Ozu moments. Period, because it's just the build up to that scene, to that this one. Conversation in a movie is just so wonderful. Not build up, but like the when you get to that scene and you realize, why the movie is what it is, it's just such a great reveal. But yeah, so it, I also put it similar to Supermarket Woman, the Itami film, with like the housewives who went to the park. And the supermarket woman is a significant part of that is the housewives who shop at the supermarkets and how they can change things, and they change the supermarkets, and this the housewives, they change, with the help of Watanabe, they change, the area and improve it.
Well, I haven't seen Supermarket Woman or Green Tea Over Rice or any of the other damn movies you're talking about.
Yeah, well, Supermarket Woman is a whole lot of fun. It's really funny. It's his take on a romance, even though he kind of plays with the whole idea of a romance in a really fun way.
Unfortunately, we'll
But
never be able to watch it again because Filmstruck died.
You can get a 10-pack of all 10 of his movies on eBay.
Never again.
Okay. They're Korean DVDs, so, but all region. Anyways, that's, yeah, let's eat, Karu. It's, kind of a masterpiece. All right, so for the final time, do you wanna... We were supposed to have a guest, but he was too busy being a film critic and all that stuff. But he did post a review of Ikaru on Letterboxd that...
Just finished this blind spot in my Kurosawa knowledge, and I'm glad I did. Takashi Shimura is one of Japan's most emotive actors, and he grounds this Dostoevsky-esque exploration of death and bureaucracy with tremendous pathos. A beautiful celebration of the things we do to give our lives meaning.
Yeah, yeah. So
Clint Worthington.
Yeah. But what else was there? I didn't remember the Spielberg thing. So other 1952-53 movies.
Jeez.
For a very last time, until we start up again with another project I haven't picked a name for.
Well, 1952 era, an episode we did on Please Don't Send Me in Outer Space, the other podcast I do, was on the movie The Machine That Kills Bad People, which is a Roberto Rossellini film, 1952.
Oh, the father of Isabella Rossellini.
That's correct, yes. That's what he's famous for. Also, he directed a few movies.
Yeah, a few.
And this is it's a really silly movie about a terrible little town that where the money is being spent on, you know, the upper class people and the lower class people aren't doing this. And this one guy gets a chance to take care of business, so to speak, when he gets a camera from an evil, mischievous person that whenever he takes a photo, and he doesn't realize this at first, he just figures it out by use that he takes a photo of somebody and that person dies later. But there are all kinds of things that get in the way, like if he takes a photo of them through an object, that person just gets really sick, they don't actually die, and they freeze in place, and there's all these funny things that end up happening. And it's a really silly Italian movie, a little bit neorealism style, but I think that was just the way they were making movies then. And I recommend it. I don't know where it's available, because where I watched it was on Filmstruck, but I'm sure it's out there somewhere.
It could be like a box set of Italian stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's a Roberto Rossellini movie. It's probably around somewhere.
I bet his daughter has a copy of it.
Yeah, go ask.
But anyway, this isn't about Isabella Rossellini. A movie we both enjoy from 52 is Umberto D. This very... it's very bleak at times, and also kind of uplifting, and there's some funny moments. Neorealism film about an old man and his pet dog, and he has one human friend, Maria, who is the maid at the apartment building where he lives, and it's just him kind of going through life, and you get to see Italy post-World War II with them, how they're dealing with veterans, and the way you deal with veterans in that movie. It's kind of how we deal with veterans in America right now, unfortunately. It's really upsetting when you can't see this. It has a separate DVD release. It has one of the most horrific animal sequences I've ever seen, where you don't see an animal get killed on screen, but it's implied an animal is killed, and I found that to be deeply upsetting to watch. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, it's got a whole bunch of upsetting stuff in it.
Yeah, just the dog catcher stuff was just so upsetting.
It somehow manages to pepper in, like, comedy in such a dour, sad movie. which is weird. Yeah. But that's, I mean, that's the way neorealism stuff worked. You know, they had to find humor in these places wherever they could. And, you know, it just shows a real window of, like, the way classes were done and monetary structures and how there was nobody to help anybody in Italy at the time. Like, it'd been torn apart by the war.
And if you watch it now, think of how the whole veterans thing, how they treat veterans, and that makes it even more upsetting. But, Umberto D is great. The dog is super adorable. Dog's name Flake. I think it was Flake or Flika, something like that. And, watch Umberto D, but be prepared for some real sadness.
I mean, that's the only one I really feel like talking about. I mean, we could talk about High Noon, I guess.
Yeah, like, High Noon's great.
Yeah.
It's in real time, which I didn't realize until I watched it last week. It's mind blowing to realize it managed to cram in all this drama, like enough for a whole film into, you know, like real time, like an hour and a half.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Like for a movie in 1952, I wonder how many movies were doing the.
Hitchcock's Rope is kind of trying to do real time because it's all quote unquote in one take.
Right.
But, it's more, that one is a lot more noticeable where High Noon is, with Rope, is like, it's very noticeable that they're trying to make it real time, but it doesn't quite work out that well, and you can see the clear cuts in time where with High Noon, it didn't occur to me until like at the end of the movie where I was like, wait a second, how dense the script is with the whole theme of responsibility. It's layered with like personal responsibility versus societal responsibility. You know, versus like, you know, should you help someone if, you know, if with a problem that is completely their fault that could get you killed? You know, it's a really great Western, and, who is it? The director, Fred Zinnemann, something like that, he did some real interesting movies in his time. He did this 1959 Nun movie with Audrey Hepburn. That is this huge epic, Hollywood film about the life of a nun in this, I think starting in 1920s, it goes into the 1940s. But anyway, it's just High Noon or any Fred Zinnemann stuff from this time is just worth seeing through.
That sounds like a good enough summary to me. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was going to break it down even more, but we don't have time for that. So, do you want to plug your show first and then say what the next project will be?
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. Force people to have to listen to us.
Yeah,
so if you want to hear me in my sarcastic tones talk about movies that are not Japanese specifically, that are science fiction and fantasy based, you can listen to Please Don't Send Me into Outer Space, which I do with my co-host Aaron and Sarah. Every week we just talk about different science fiction and fantasy movies. So for Christmas time, we're doing Prometheus because there's a Christmas tree in it.
Oh, that's why you're watching it.
Yeah, and we're also going to be doing a couple of top five lists that I've just been cooking up for a while now that we had in the can for a while. I just had to edit and do stuff, but those will be released soon.
Yeah, Prometheus, the first half, I think, is interesting and good. And then something happened in the story where it's like, oh, this wasn't thought through.
Where everything starts going to hell.
Yeah, and not even like fun going to hell, because kind of like this needed a, like another pass
Yeah. Well, it was
or
interesting
two.
watching it because we watched Alien Covenant for the podcast before. Either me or Sarah had seen Prometheus. And just like after we were done, it was like, wow, Alien Covenant was just literally the same movie, except for everyone was dumber. It's like, oh, the mystery of discovery. Oh no, crap's going crazy. Except for in that movie, like in this movie, crap goes crazy and you see like the origins of it. In Alien Covenant, crap starts going crazy just because.
Yeah.
Anyways. Yeah, those Please Don't Send Me Outer Space is available at the usual places. Check us out if you
Yeah.
please.
So I guess doing a Muppet Christmas Carol was too on the nose.
That's just not what the people wanted. It was
Okay.
either Prometheus or Scrooged.
Okay. I have a site called Jailhouse 701 Japanese Cult Cinema. Of by this by the time this comes out, there will be a couple more things. One is a review of Irezumi. I think how you pronounce it. It's one of the I think it might be considered the first of the Pinky Violence movies, or like a direct precursor to it. Irezumi, I believe, means tattoo, and about this woman getting revenge, and she has this grotesque tattoo of a spider with like a human face on her back that you get to see. Then there will be a double feature of Kenji Fukasaku cop movies, Doberman Cop, which I believe has a Sonny Chiba in it, and Cops vs. Thugs, which has Bunta Sugawara in it. Sugawara was in a whole bunch of his movies, and he died too soon. He was a treasure, and he was the voice of the boiler room wizard creature thing in Spirited Away. Was it the what was it? In the like early in the movie, you know what I'm talking about?
No. I don't know what you're talking about.
Okay. I think he did another Studio Ghibli movie too. But yeah, there'll be double feature of that, and I'm not sure what else after that. And my I think my episode of Russo Files Unite will have come out by this point in January. It's on Tarkovsky's debut film, Ivan's Childhood, which is a very grim, not very grim. I've seen Come and See. It's not that grim, but it's still a grim look at this World War II from a perspective of a child. And it's Tarkovsky, so it's gorgeous to look at. And so, Joel, do you want to announce what the next project will be?
Yeah, so I don't know if we're are we keeping the name as high and low when we switch over to our next thing, or oh, I guess we'll have to discuss that. But we're gonna cover another director for the next project, and I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. It's Michael Bay.
We didn't discuss
Oh
this.
yeah, I'm gonna be talking about The Rock. I'm gonna be talking Armageddon, and don't forget the Secret Soldiers of Benghazi.
I forgot he made that.
How could you forget?
No, what's the real one?
Oh, okay. I guess we're going to be talking about Spike Lee. I mean, I think we've kind of like teased about this before on the podcast. Yeah. We're going to be covering Spike Lee and all of his movies. Hopefully he'll release something while we're still doing this. Obviously BlacKkKlansman just came out, and
And he had another movie come out this year too. It was a real small indie thing that I'm trying to find, but it hasn't got like a big release yet.
that's cool. Yeah, so there's lots of things to dig into, and it's a different, it's going to have a different tone than what we've been talking about here. And instead of just doing, a random American movie that came out the same year as whatever Spike Lee movie we're talking about. We're specifically going to be picking at some award winners, you know, Oscars or Golden Lion, that sort of thing.
Yeah, like Best Picture or What One Can, if, whatever.
Yeah.
So it won't be so it'll be kind of interesting looking at Spike versus, you know, because he's always been kind of like a rebel too, you know, like mainstream Hollywood. You know, he has made some Hollywood films, but, you know, he's kind of antagonistic towards mainstream Hollywood a bit, too.
Yeah.
And very critical of them. Sometimes fairly, sometimes out of the blue, where it's like, why did he have to say that? But, yeah, we'll get into that. And I can say what the first episode will be.
Sure.
His longest movie, because we did Seven Samurai first, because it's 3.5 hours. We're doing Malcolm X first, because it's Spike's longest movie at 3 hours.
Yeah, and don't expect that episode for a month or two. What are we aiming for, March or?
March, April time, probably.
Yeah, we're going to take a little break to cool off our brains and readjust. I'm going to be trying to do a watch through of a bunch of his stuff just in preparation, and then obviously Spencer and I have not exactly hammered out the exact details, so, but
yeah,
you know,
there's some stuff it needs to be clarified a bit, because it's a vaguer a format we're doing now.
Yeah,
but in the first special episode, because I'll try to do more special episodes, because there's some important Black films and African films that I really want to talk about. The first one will be on Daughters of the Dust, because that movie is incredible and needs to be talked about more. And so
it's on Canopy.
And it's on streaming on not Netflix, Amazon.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it's great. And expect some of the same people to come back. Hopefully a bunch of new people. I have some other people I'm going to try to contact in the meantime. So, look forward to that. The title, all that stuff, schedule, it's still kind of up in the air. But, see you guys in 2 to 3 months.
I hope you enjoyed us talking about these things. I mean, there is still technically the other episode that's going to be released at the same time, but yeah, I hope you enjoyed us. We really enjoyed talking about Kurosawa. Thanks, Spencer, for inviting me along with this journey.
Oh, you're welcome. I can't remember why. I think I picked you because I did the episode of Face of Another on your show.
Yeah.
And you said you've seen it, so I was kind of like, oh, okay, this is a good person.
This guy actually knows a thing.
Yeah. But, we'll do all the big proper thank yous in the other episode. All
right.
So, sayonara.
Signing off, bye.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. The show's Twitter is @highandlowpod. The show can be found on Facebook under the title of High and Low, a Kurosawa podcast. The show is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Podbean. We are no longer on Podiant. Thank you for listening.
Lives on the fourth floor, we're in the basement.
Yes, my office, let it speak.
With a marionette tank waiting for wet hands to sip in the limp end. Fuck.